Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Ryan Marr, who actually goes by Bud Marr. He is the director of the National Institute for Newman Studies. That's located in Pittsburgh, correct?
Yes.
Good. And he's the author of To Be Perfect, It Is to Have Changed Often, The Development of John Henry Newman's Ecclesiological Outlook, 1845 to 1877. Guy couldn't make up his mind. Is that what you're saying?
No, well, in part, but really, Newman's views on the church changed over time through different experiences that he had within the church, so he kind of gained insight through these different events in his life, and that's what the book traces out.
And the book is Roman and Littlefield. It came out just last year, 2018. He also edited the volume, The Oxford Handbook of John Henry Newman, likewise, that came out in 2018, a productive year for you last year.
Well, yeah, and the only qualifier I would have there is I wasn't the editor, but a contributor, but it was great to be a part of that Oxford Handbook, yeah.
Oh, good, good, okay. All right, let's go ahead and jump into the recent news, the word about Cardinal Newman and sainthood. What's going on there? Where are we?
Yeah, so in the fall of last year, word came out that a second miracle had been approved towards Newman's canonization. We actually don't have a ton of details about that. It was involved a woman in Chicago who was pregnant and was having some serious complications with the pregnancy that put both her health and the life of the child in danger. And through Newman's intercession, she experienced a miracle in this case that exceeded natural explanations. And so with that taking place, the path was cleared. Here at NINS, of course, we are thrilled to hear that Pope Francis has approved Newman's canonization, and all signs point to that taking place in October of this year, although that hasn't officially been announced yet.
Why did Newman come up for canon? I mean, why in the last few years has this become a push?
Well, it seems like the last few popes, I would say especially Paul VI and then Benedict the 16th, had a devotion to Newman. And both of those popes mentioned him as a powerful example of someone who followed the truth wherever it would lead. And for Newman, that really involved, he had a comfortable and, I guess you could say, prestigious, like for an intellectual, he was a fellow at Oxford. And as he dug deeper into church history and learned more about all that was involved in the twists and turns of church history, eventually felt himself called to the Catholic Church. So he left behind that comfortable Oxford existence and dealt then with all the anti-Catholicism that was prevalent in England at the time, so as to follow his conscience into the church.
You know, a lot of people don't realize, I think, the degree of anti-Catholicism that you had in England. I mean, I mean, figure like Alexander Pope, the great poet, he had a house up in Twickenham, as it was called, a beautiful house. He made a lot of money, mostly off of his translation of Homer. But he couldn't own property in the city of London proper because he was a Catholic. And that's only, you know, he dies in the 1740s. So he dies only less than 60 years before Newman was born. It's not that long a time.
Well, that's right, Mark. And I think for us, it is difficult to step into that world. Because in our day and age, we really do put on these kind of commitments as sort of like hats, you know. We might switch from, like, a person in modern day America might go from growing up Christian to practicing Buddhist meditation, and no one really thinks much about it. You know, I went from evangelical to Catholic, and my parents, it was something they had to adjust to, but I was thinking, like, what would it take to really surprise them? Probably more than that. But in Newman's day and age, and like you're saying, especially the half century before that, there was still a lot of prejudice against Catholics, where for a Catholic priest to walk down the street wearing his clerics, he might experience some hostility. You didn't have the same voting rights. You couldn't serve in the government. So Newman came under a lot of derision for this decision.
And he was, this is a point you just made. He was comfortable. Life was good. He could live out the rest of his life in a distinguished position without any of this kind of controversy about sectarian disputes. But it was he followed the truth.
I think it really is like a kind of white martyrdom for him, where, you know, it wasn't the threat of physical violence, but he left behind that comfortability. He lost friendships because of that. You know, I mean, it was, I mean, to be honest, it was front page news. It was something that everyone paid attention to because Newman had a sort of celebrity status as a prominent minister and leader of the Oxford movement in the Church of England.
And it did mean, it was big news. And even you know, I first came across Newman in a college survey class of English literature. It was you know, one of these year-long three-part surveys from Beowulf up to W.H. Auden. And there in the Victorian period, we read the Norton Anthology of English Literature that everyone read back then. And there were a few selections from this Cardinal Newman figure. And you had selections from his autobiography, the Apologia. And then you also had selections of him on education. And in those Victorian discussions, you know, for the class, if you're at UCLA in 1980, the idea that one becoming Catholic after being, Anglican, so what? I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, you know, you may make those changes all the time. And the teacher, he couldn't impress upon us the full reality of what that meant in mid 19th century England.
Well, and the kind of thing that you're talking about, it has a real, it's personal for me. I was studying at Duke Divinity School back in the aughts, and you know, Newman had a far-ranging thought. Like, he was someone who could write an incredibly nuanced essay and sort of balance ideas and tension. But he also could cut right to the heart of the matter. And I remember the first time coming across his phrase that to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And in a time where a lot of theology was written sort of from a detached academic perspective, I mean, that kind of hit me like cold water. It's a claim that has to be dealt with, right? And so that was really a spark in my own journey into the Catholic Church.
What is the future for the canonization here? What are the steps that have to follow now? We've got two miracles,
and it's been the Congregation for the Cause of Saints presented basically like a dossier to the Holy Father, saying, like setting forth Newman as worthy to be raised to the dignity of the altar. And I think Pope Francis has pretty much green-lighted it. So now it is just a matter of scheduling and logistics and all that's involved with bringing thousands of pilgrims to Rome.
Now, Newman's reputation today, sort of the more popular interpretation of those who've looked at him, see him as a stern critic of liberalism, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
First, maybe I should ask you, what does that mean? What was the liberalism in 1840 that distressed Newman?
Well, see, it's fascinating because Newman is a figure, to be quite honest, that he appeals to Catholics across the spectrum. And what I mean by that in part is that you will find Catholics on the left who very much are drawn to and appeal to Newman. Even some of the modernists did so back in the day. And I think it's wanting to harness ideas like the sense of the faithful and his understanding of the development of doctrine, and to give those, I guess, like what I would call an exaggerated sense. But Newman, at various points in his life, but especially in his Biglietto speech after he was named a cardinal by Pope Leo XIII, he was insistent that his entire career was a battle against liberalism. Now, he qualifies in that speech. He says, I don't have in mind in this case actually a kind of like political liberalism, but he calls it liberalism in religion. And this is the idea for Newman that doctrine doesn't matter, that it can be like whether a person is Muslim or Christian, Protestant or Catholic, that's not essential, that there's this kind of openness to use the terminology of the day, this kind of latitudinarian approach to doctrine. So this kind of breadth of doctrine that in the end, ultimately, evacuates like propositional content to the faith.
And this was a powerful force in English society at that time.
Yeah, Newman was concerned about it already as an Anglican that, you know, as he saw liberalism making headway in the Church of England and in English politics, that in some ways, like, a person would not have to be confessionally Anglican to teach at a university or something like that. That was very problematic to Newman, although he ultimately landed in a place where he thought the Church of England didn't have the tools, you know, necessary to fight it.
And the relationship between liberalism and politics, there must have been some connection there, though.
Like, the flip side to all of this is Newman was anti-Erastian, and that is the idea that the head of state has higher authority in church affairs than the bishops themselves. And he saw this encroachment taking place in the Church of England, where like in some ways final say rested with the monarch or with parliament. And so that's again was part of his problem, or like the difficulties that he was wrestling with as an Anglican.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you take John Stuart Mill's liberalism, which is pushing a more sort of the main, you know, maintaining individual rights, individual conscience, preserving the voice of the minority against the tyranny of the majority, and just the general individualism that he is the grandfather of contemporary liberalism, laid out in On Liberty there, and also sort of pushing a pluralistic outlook that says you can believe whatever you want as long as it doesn't infringe upon what anyone else wants to believe, you know, in rational limits there. But is that sort of the spirit of liberalism in religion as well at this time?
Yeah, so Newman, there's a thread in some of his sermons where he talks about a coming age of apostasy or infidelity. And Newman already saw this kind of unfolding in his own time. And he said, the future that awaits Christians, he was thinking particularly of England, but I think in all of the West, is an age, he said, that would make St. Athanasius and St. Ambrose shudder. Because we don't know a world that's post-Christian. You know, like, we know what paganism was like. But a world unmoored from Christian values, Newman knew that to confront this would require a special courage and a special dose of grace. And so those two are related because they're both, like, liberalism and religion, the downplaying of doctrine as foundational, and then liberalism and politics are both grounded in a false anthropology. And that's what Newman was working against in part.
Do you think that his fears of liberalism and religion have come true?
Yeah, you know, I've wondered how Newman might look at the Church of England today, or like at Episcopalianism. In some ways, I don't think he would be surprised by the doctrinal drift. He may be taken aback at how quickly some of those things have proceeded. And so, I would say, in many ways, his suspicions have been confirmed.
Did he think that the kind of the softening of doctrine, just sort of lightening up on the insistence on specific dogmas, that would lead to a diminished church attendance?
I'm not sure if he ever connected those two. You know, he does talk. He has this fascinating idea that Christianity pre-creeds was sort of like a pristine state of the faith, and that there was sort of this immediacy between the believer and the mysteries of the faith. But he saw creeds as necessary once, you know, heresy arose. But I'm not sure he ever got into the question of like how this might affect the rate of attendance at the liturgy and things like that.
Well, it seems to me that one of the principles of liberalism and the kind of free exercise of conscience and individual will and individual desire is that people will like it better, that they will be happier when they have more freedom, and that they're less rule-bound. But I actually don't think that the psychology literature supports that idea that more choice, more freedom necessarily means more happiness.
Well, I think for Newman too, building off what you're saying, is that like church attendance and even the church's authority to, in some sense, like bound people under the pain of sin to be present at the Mass each week, that's connected to all these questions that Newman is addressing. And so he said, you know, like Newman thought at the end of the day that private judgment was the principle of Protestant practice. And so for him, you know, the question of doctrine was really related to the question of authority. And he called present church authority like a standing apostolic committee. And so to respond to the voice of those who stand as successors of apostles was in some ways to relate analogously to the calling of the first generation of Christians and what they would have faced.
And he said, you say in one of your interviews, you say that Newman's position was that conscience and church authority exist in a reciprocal, not competitive, relationship. Now, a liberal would say that, no, conscience and authority of any kind can't help but be on some level in an adversarial relationship. What would Newman say to that?
Newman thought that he said that that life in the church creates the arena for conscience and authority to come into a fruitful relationship. And he thought for the church to attack conscience would really be to saw off the limb on which it sits, because it's precisely through conscience, which is what Newman called the aboriginal vicar of Christ, that church authority finds traction in the minds and hearts of believers. Now, that being said, there's a way that we talk about primacy of conscience today, or that some people do, that I think is completely inimical to what Newman had in mind. So he warned in the late 19th century of this understanding, like this false idea of consciousness, or conscience, I should say, that he described as the right of self-will. You see this really resonates in or echoes in the writings of Pope Benedict XVI, where he says, you know, like we can't talk about conscience properly without bringing into question the idea of forming our consciences properly. And that's something that really gets lost in some of these conversations.
When I hear about him talking about the, you know, the power of conscience, it does lead me to his ideas about education. And in those readings, you know, in my English literature undergraduate days, what really was highlighted was Newman's idea of education, you know, the idea of a university being a place where there was a great freedom of thought, but in this particular sense was so important to him, the idea that there is knowledge that is good for its own sake, right? Knowledge that is not tied to any external purpose, knowledge that isn't utilitarian in some way, that it is just, it is good to know Shakespeare. And we can think of all these reasons that one should know Shakespeare, but Newman wants to say, look, ultimately, it's just good to know Shakespeare, that this is a knowledge that needn't be tied to the world in any concrete sense. And that this really builds the sense of conscience as something that should be developed in company with the great traditions, not just religious traditions, but also the great traditions of civilization.
Well, I think that's right, Mark. And Alistair MacIntyre, the great living philosopher at Notre Dame, he's really picked up some of the threads in Newman's writings on education and developed them and said, like, in our own day, even at many Catholic colleges, we've lost this sense of the coherency of knowledge, like knowledge as a unified understanding of the world, so that, again, even at many Catholic schools, like the different disciplines are siloed off into their own existence. And it has to do with what you're talking about with the instrumentalization of knowledge. Like, so even with Catholic young people, sometimes we sell education as like a pragmatic affair. Where really for great Christian thinkers like Newman, this is an opportunity to know more about the world and thereby know more about the one who created it. But like intimated there, it can't be done well if it's cut off from the rest of the tradition. And that's not only when we talk about theology, but when we think about education as this unified whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see when people in the humanities look upon what has happened in the last few years of the pretty severe downturn in enrollments. You know, I know that there's one study came out from the American Historical Association just a few months ago showing that the history majors had dropped more than 30% since 2011. And the response by the humanities professors is often the utilitarian one. We have to show them the concrete benefits of a humanities degree. And so they will talk about, you know, that they do well on the job market, they develop critical thinking skills and problem-solving skills and communication skills, and so on. But what they don't argue is the Newman point about humanities education being good because it's a humanities education. That again, knowledge of Shakespeare for its own sake. And that we needn't tie it to, well, I mean, some people tie it to career skills, other people tie humanities education to social justice aims. And I think that it's better to go back to Newman and say we value Shakespeare because we value Shakespeare. And one, we don't need to make an argument for why you need to read Shakespeare or why you need to read the King James Bible simply as a form of your acculturation. That the value of reading King James is in reading King James. And let's just leave it at that. Once we start having to argue for it, we're going to lose. We're going to lose because we're going to start getting the utilitarian points that other fields are going to make more strongly than we will.
Yeah, for Newman, there was an intrinsic goodness to knowing the world and becoming more humane through the studies that you're talking about. And that didn't need to be justified on a pragmatic level because Newman had a conception like in the vein of someone like St. Thomas Aquinas, of these transcendent goods that brought us into that drew us closer to God. He also had a profound sense of providence and the operation of divine providence in his own life, but also in history. And so a lot of this gets back to a discussion about how do we do a particular discipline well? And in many contexts, like when you think about history, it really does the narration of history follows according to like this materialistic conception of the world, whereas Newman looked at history as, again, another means to see God's loving salvific plan at work. But there's not a lot of history kind of done in that mode today.
No, not at all. What are two of your favorite stories of Newman?
Well, I do, you know, one of them that comes immediately to mind is after Newman had gotten into some hot water with his essay on consulting the faithful, and he's called into the bishop's office, so Bishop Oglethorne of Birmingham.
This is before his conversion or after?
No, I'm sorry. This is in the mid-1850s after his conversion.
Okay.
And so Newman says, he makes the argument in this essay that as the church discerns doctrinal development, as it discusses these matters, that one of the witnesses to tradition is the voice of the faithful. And the bishop calls him into his office and says, you know, like, why, when things were at peace, did you have to stir the waters?
Yeah, so, okay, what, troublemaker?
Yeah, that's right. And Newman and him, like, we hear this story from Newman's side. It really comes out of his journals. But they're arguing about this. And at one point, Bishop Oglethorne says sort of dismissively, like, who are the laity? And Newman says, well, we'd look pretty foolish without them. And to me, that that story captures, to me, kind of the balance in Newman's perspective. The phrase voice of the faithful in our own day, that's become sometimes like sort of shorthand for opposing the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. But Newman had this mm-hmm. dynamic understanding of ecclesiology where you have the three offices of the church, which mirror the three offices of Christ, prophet, priest, and king. And the church is healthiest when these operate in a relationship of mutual support.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like in his own time, one voice that was maybe sometimes lost or obscured was the voice of the faithful. When you look at things like the Arian controversy or defining of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, it really was the devotion of the faithful that played a key role in those things, you know, being defined.
I've got to remember that response. Well, who are the laity? Well, we'd look pretty silly without them.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good. That's good. Okay. Well, let me jump to what are two fundamental lessons for us today that you would take from Newman? Give me two strong reasons why everyone should pay attention to Newman today.
Well, I think one reason that really jumps out to me is that Newman could be very upfront about his struggles, even as a Catholic, with different elements of the church's life. And anyone who cares a great deal about the church knows this to be the case, whether that's scandal in the church or, you know, difficulties with even the way that our church leaders maybe witness to the truth, to put it, you know, sort of diplomatically. And Newman, whenever faced with these things, and as he was like a pastor of the souls, they would sometimes ask him, like, I'm really struggling. So at that time, some felt like Pius IX, especially as Vatican I unfolded, they felt like he was too authoritarian. And Newman always counseled these souls, like, have a little faith, you know, have a little trust. If we look over the course of church history, the church faces turbulent waters, it faces storms, but God remains faithful. And I think, you know, we all need to hear that in our own time, even sometimes to sort of dial us back when we're tempted on social media or wherever to, you know, cleanse the temple, so to speak. So I feel like that's one key truth from Newman. As a second truth, I would return to, and this is sort of related to the first point that I was making, but to a trust in divine providence. We've already talked some about Newman's conversion story, and you certainly see you see that coming to the fore there. But this really shows up in his writings, and it can be a great source of spiritual comfort, regardless of where we find ourselves at in life. So Newman, you know, with all this talk about Newman becoming a saint, it raises for me like the question of the theology of sainthood. And sometimes the saints, like we read about St. Padre Pio and, you know, bilocation or the stigmata of St. Francis, and they seem very far removed from everyday experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Newman was someone himself who he's like, one time someone said, like, they raised this question, do you think you'll be a saint someday? And he's like, well, saints aren't literary men. They don't write novels, et cetera, et cetera. So he kind of, with proper humility, dismissed this idea about himself. But I mean, I think one thing that Newman really shows us is that the saints aren't, it's not that they have supernatural capacities, but that they're open to God's grace. And we see this in Newman's life, and it's a call to all of us that we're like, don't sell the gospel short, right? Like, don't sell the power of the cross short. We're called to great things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of humility goes along nicely with his sense of history. When he says you ignoring history, ignoring the long legacy, really is a form of arrogance. And to say to yourself, okay, my individual the error of contemporary liberalism would be to say that my conscience has greater wisdom than 2,000 years of an institution, one that has survived for that long. And I would say, who am I? Where did this remarkable trust in my own judgment come from? And so when I go back and read Newman, I just have that subtext that I carry with me that he nicely reinforces.
Well, Newman, he said that sometimes a heresy was just pressing an idea before its time, or taking an idea that was true insofar as it went, but then, you know, elevating it to the exclusion of other key parts of the faith. So, you know, different people talk about Catholicism being the religion of the both and. But you're right, Newman had this trust in divine providence, and also a sense, so like when he talked about the sense of the faithful, in some ways you could say like, well, the bishops have to do more to listen to the faithful. But for him, it really put a responsibility on all of us. Like if we're called to witness to the faith, we're incumbent to know more, as much of the history as we can. Now, there's different stations in life, and not everyone is an intellectual, but it calls us to a deeper understanding of the faith to the extent that we can enter into the history, but certainly the devotions and the liturgy that really ground us in the mysteries of the faith.
Bud Maher, thank you for being with us. And let me mention Bud, the title of your book from last year again. To Be Perfect Is to Have Changed Often, The Development of John Henry Newman's Ecclesiological Outlook, 1845 to 1877. Thank you, Bud.
Okay, thanks, Mark.